there's still strong perception that Pakistan has a lot of influence with the Taliban.
U.S. Secretary of State visits Pakistan amid questions between the nations. It's Wednesday, September 5th. This is VOA Asia. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. We're also on Facebook at VOA Asia. Coming up, child marriage remains a reality in Asia and the United States. With a successful Asian Games, Indonesia looks to hosting the Olympics. Chinese investments and dim sum, world-hungry bugs and self-navigating robots. It's all on today's VOA Asia. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo is due to visit Pakistan today for the first high-level official meetings with leaders of the newly elected government in Islamabad, as bilateral relations have deteriorated to the lowest ebb in the past year. VOA's Ayaz Gul in Islamabad spoke with our Ira Melman about the expectations of both sides as the meeting approaches.
Well, I think before his arrival, the U.S. officials have already made it very clear that this visit is primarily to remind Pakistan that there is still job to be done in terms of clearing militants of Pakistani soil that the U.S. believes are behind attacks inside Afghanistan. You know, that war in Afghanistan is already has already entered in the 17th year, and it's becoming more and more deadly and putting a lot of pressure on the U.S.-led coalition, which has been trying to basically help Afghan forces maintain control over the territory under the Afghan government. But what we have seen over the last few weeks is that the Taliban is on the offensive and has captured more territory and has killed so many Afghan soldiers that it has now put a lot of pressure on Washington how to go about a peaceful settlement for this conflict. And that is where the role of Pakistan comes, because there's still strong perception that Pakistan has a lot of influence with the Taliban, and that those Taliban leaders who are using Pakistani soil for plotting attacks inside Afghanistan, that Islamabad can influence them and push them to go for negotiations with the Afghan government. That's what Pompeo is going to bring to the table when he sits down with Pakistan's Foreign Minister Shah Mahmood Qureshi and Prime Minister Imran Khan, who have just taken control of the newly elected government hardly 2 weeks ago.
And that is the next question, as to what is the difference that Pompeo and Joint Chiefs of Staff Chairman General Joseph Dunford faces with a new administration atop the Pakistan government.
Imran Khan has been, campaigning that Pakistan should not rely on any foreign assistance that it has been receiving over the past 17 years from the U.S. to fight war, because Imran Khan believes that this is what has weakened Pakistan's position internally and externally. And here is a leader now who has solely, who's become the prime minister of this country based on these slogans that no cooperation with the U.S. in return for money. It has to be a mutually benefited, a relationship mutually benefited to both the countries. So these are the things which Imran Khan's government will be placing before Pompeo's delegation. And so that is why there are very low expectations, are really low, whether there will be any reasonable outcome to the demands that Pakistan has to fight these militants who are allegedly using the Pakistani soil, because that is the United States' primary concern. But here is a leader who has done something different. And if he goes ahead and does exactly the same thing that the previous Pakistani rulers have been doing, I think it will be a major setback, political setback for this new government. And there will be a lot of criticism at home. So this is the first time that a dialogue is going to take place between the two countries where neither side is willing or will be willing to back down on its stated position.
The Pentagon announced last week it has decided to scrap $300 million in military aid to Pakistan, citing the country's lack of cooperation with President Trump's South Asia strategy. The United States has now withheld $800 million from its so-called coalition support funds since the start of the year. An American military training program for Pakistani officers also stands terminated, and civilian financial assistance to Islamabad has already declined to zero, according to officials. These are among some of the top Asia stories you'll find right now on voanews.com. Critics say Myanmar Reuters' verdict is an attack on press freedom. Tensions run high over China refugees at Pacific meeting. Surveillance common for some Hong Kong pro-democracy activists. South Korean envoy to carry letter on denuclearization to North. Secret to Japan couple's 80 years of marriage? Wife's patience. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also stop by the voanews.com website. VOA Asia continues. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. The United Nations considers marriage under the age of 18 to be a human rights violation. While the highest occurrence is in the least developed nations, including several areas of Asia, child marriage is also a reality in the United States. Researchers at the UCLA Fielding School of Public Health found some 78,000 American children between 15 and 17 years old are or have recently been married. VOA's Elizabeth Lee has more on the effects of being married so young in the United States.
Sarah Tasneem was forced to grow up sooner than her peers. When she was 15, her father gave her to a 28-year-old man to be married.
My dad had become involved in a very kind of like, it's basically kind of like a cult, separate from like the religion of Islam, I think. It was your role as a girl that you would just, you know, be a wife and a mom.
Tasneem, who uses this name to protect her identity, said she was spiritually married to the man and taken away from her own family.
We left the country, went back to where he was originally from, and came back about 6 months later when I was pregnant and 16 years old. And we were legally married in Reno. I got really depressed, and I just remember seeing, like, you know, kids my age going to school and thinking, you know, I want to be one of those kids.
Tasneem's experience is not unique in the U.S. A study of data from the Census Bureau's American Community Survey finds that from 2010 to 2014, some 78,000 American children between 15 and 17 years old said they were married.
It's a problem because they're less likely to finish high school, 31% more likely to land in poverty in adulthood, and for girls, their health is threatened when they give birth young, and the health of their babies is threatened.
The data also shows an aspect of child marriage that sets the U.S. apart from other countries.
The boys are getting married young, too.
The study shows higher numbers of children of American Indian and Chinese descent were married. Immigrant children were more likely than U.S.-born children to have been married.
This is not unique to any one religion. There are child marriages across all ethnic groups and countries of origin, but those children who come from families that originated in Latin America, the Middle East, or East Asia do have higher rates. It is also the case that children whose parents were born here in the United States still have far higher rates than would be acceptable.
Tasneem had two children with her husband before she could get a divorce.
So I really felt robbed. I felt robbed of my education. And to this day, I'm still fighting to get my education back.
At 37 years old, her children are grown, and she recently remarried. But getting to this point has not been easy.
There's really no way to make somebody whole after, taking away their freedom.
Researchers say survivors' stories may help the public understand the effects of being married too young. Elizabeth Lee, VOA News, Los Angeles.
Happening now in Asia, one person was reported dead, several others injured after a bridge collapsed in the eastern Indian city of Kolkata. A 30-meter segment of the bridge fell on the train tracks below, along with several cars and a bus. Authorities said several more people might still be trapped underneath the rubble. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. This is VOA Asia. We're glad to have you with us today. The 18th Asian Games ended in the Indonesian capital, Jakarta, this past Sunday, with China predictably winning the lion's share of gold medals at 132, followed by Japan with 75, South Korea with 49, and host Indonesia with 31. Even a joint Korean team won the gold in the 500-meter dragon boat race. Indonesia's successful performance has raised the possibility that it will bid to host the 2032 Summer Olympic Games. Brian Bridges is an adjunct professor at Hong Kong's Lingan University, and he tells VOA's Victor Beatty Indonesia's performance was particularly noteworthy because it had a relatively short time to prepare after Vietnam had to pull out as host over budgetary concerns.
So from what we can see, it was very successful in terms of the publicity and so on, but also that most things seemed to work quite well. There was some doubt, I guess, a little bit about the air pollution issue, but beyond that, it seems to have been a very successful Games.
So successful, Indonesia wants to bid for the 2032 Olympics.
Indeed, yes. This is somewhat of a surprise, I think, probably to some Indonesians, but also to some of the fellow members of ASEAN in Southeast Asia, that there have been talks over the last few years on and off about perhaps a joint Olympic bid by several Southeast Asian states, but the Indonesians and obviously President Jokowi are so happy with what they've just done in the last couple of weeks that they now feel that they are strong enough to make a bid on their own.
Thomas Bach, head of the IOC, warned Indonesia not to fall into what he called a black hole after the Asian Games if it wants to compete in 2032. What does he mean?
I think he means basically the legacy of what comes out of these particular Games in 2018. In other words, the facilities and so on, are those still being used years later? Now, the time the bid comes, the official bid for 2032 comes up, it will not be until 2024, 2025, usually 7 years in advance, that the actual decision is made. So I think what the IOC president is saying, well, let's look and see whether the legacy that you promised from these Asian Games in terms of A, facilities, and B, Indonesians being more actively involved in sports actually carries out. I guess the other aspect of the legacy would be, you know, does this really provide the momentum to make Indonesians as a whole more active in playing sport? Indonesia has a very strong reputation in a number of sports, badminton and so on, and obviously won a number of gold medals this time in non-Olympic sports, which nonetheless featured at the Asian Games. But how do you create a kind of sporting culture across the broad swathes of what is a huge country and a large population?
Among the highlights, of course, China predictably came in top in the gold medal list with 132, followed by Japan, and then South Korea, and then, of course, in fourth place, Indonesia. And also Korea ended up with a united team. Any surprises at these games?
The host country always has an advantage, seemingly, in these kind of games, so it's perhaps not altogether a surprise that Indonesia came in fourth position. I think the interesting change is that China did not win overall as many gold medals or medals of any category as it had done in the previous one. And secondly, that Japan basically overtook South Korea to become a serious challenger. And I think we should bear this in mind because of 2020 Olympics. I think that the Japanese did particularly well in Olympic-related sports, sports which will feature in 2020. So I think this is something that the Chinese will have to bear in mind. The Chinese, of course, because of historical reasons and so on, will want to do very well in 2020 Tokyo. But I think the Japanese themselves have shown themselves to be clearly very determined to also put on a good show and prepare well for 2020.
But Brian Bridges said China, hosting both the Winter Olympics and the next Asian Games in the same year of 2022, points up that China remains a global sporting power. As for the Koreas, he said their unprecedented joint effort hopefully holds a lot of symbolic value as they take tentative steps toward easing tensions. Coming up, China entices Africa, while dim sum may be running out. You're listening to VOA Asia.
VOA Special English. A way to learn American English and much more. Broadcasting a half hour of world news and features every day on radio. You can also find Special English on television and online at voaspecialenglish.com. For 50 years, helping people understand world events and the language and culture of America.
This news from VOA Asia, a new high-speed rail station linking Hong Kong and mainland China, opened Tuesday under Chinese authority, raising new worries among Hong Kong residents of a further erosion of the territory's autonomy. The station will be subject to Chinese law and patrolled by mainland security officers. You're free to roam on VOA Asia Facebook each day. This is VOA Asia. As VOA Asia continues, China offers more investment aid to Africa, while dim sum dining may soon be over at a well-known restaurant. These are the topics on today's VOA Asia Business Scene with Skylar Ogden.
African leaders gathered in Beijing this week for a summit focused on economic ties. President Xi Jinping offered another $60 billion in financing for Africa, promising to focus on development projects that are sustainable. Chinese President Xi Jinping:
China will always be a good friend, good partner, and good brother of Africa. No one can destroy the great unity of the Chinese and African people.
Critics have said that China is burying some countries under massive debt and taking advantage of Africa's natural resources. They also attack the president for using Chinese instead of African labor. But at Beijing's Great Hall of the People this week, African leaders were quick to defend the Chinese president. South Africa's president, Cyril Ramaphosa:
FOCAC refutes the view that a new colonialism is taking hold in Africa, as our detractors would have us believe.
President Xi had announced another pledge of $60 billion in development assistance just 3 years ago at another gathering in Johannesburg. In Hong Kong, one of the city's oldest Cantonese restaurants, Lin Hung Tea House, could soon be a relic of the past. Now the owners are worried their new landlord, CSI Properties, will not renew their lease. Terrence Lam is a spokesperson for the Lin Hung restaurant.
The nature of a family business is sustained by every generation. It's not only a business, but it embodies the past legacy. The tea house represents the hardship from the ancestors. We hope we can protect it.
According to U.S.-based Demographia, Hong Kong had the most expensive real estate in the world in 2017. Redevelopment is popular across the city, and the selling off of older buildings, as well as spiraling rents, has spelled the end for a number of family-run neighborhood favorites across Hong Kong. Lin Hung is one of the city's oldest Cantonese restaurant businesses and is run by the Nan family, who arrived from the southern Chinese province of Guangdong and set it up in 1926. Its possible demise has upset its loyal customer base, who come here as much for the food as for a feeling of tradition and nostalgia. A local customer:
if a person has eaten at a place for decades, of course they'll have emotions.
The lease for Lin Hung Tea House expires in March. But at least for now, waiters still push around the steaming trolleys of dim sum as impatient diners clamor for more. For VOA's Business Scene, I'm Skylar Ogden.
This news from VOA Asia: more than 1 million people have been ordered to evacuate their homes as Typhoon Jebi sweeps over parts of Japan's west coast. At least 6 people have been killed. Jebi made landfall earlier Tuesday and is the strongest typhoon to hit Japan in 25 years. You'll find more on this story and much more at VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, a new study finds that when temperatures around the world start creeping up, insects that eat crops will not only become hungrier, but their numbers will grow. Scientists say this will mean more insect damage to wheat, corn, and rice crops, and therefore less food on the dinner table. We're hungry for more with VOA's Mariama Diallo.
The new study looked at dozens of pest insects and claims the hotter weather will speed up their metabolism, making them greedy for more food like rice, grains, and other plants.
If you put them into a warmer environment, they burn more calories, just like lots of different animals on Earth. And if you burn more calories, you've got to eat more to sustain your energy demand. And if you're eating more and you're an insect that eats a crop, it means you're damaging crops more.
The study makes its predictions based on computer simulations of bug and weather activity. According to lead author Curtis Deutsch, a University of Washington climate scientist, the impact is at least as great as global warming.
Right now, insects consume about 10% of our food before it ever gets to grow or to be harvested. If we don't stop climate change, by the end of this century, they'll probably consume 15 to 20%.
This year in Europe, many countries sizzled in a heat wave with record temperatures. The study estimates that if temperatures continue to rise, American corn, wheat, and rice losses from insects will jump from more than 8 million tons, an increase of nearly 36% above current bug damage. Outside the United States, the study suggests that 10 countries from Europe to East Asia could also see a doubling of wheat losses from bugs. Mariama Diallo, VOA News.
Science fiction has long teased consumers about a future where robots are our personal assistants. But it's no longer science fiction. VOA's Arash Arabasadi tells us the recent spike in consumer-grade smart speakers that respond to users' voice commands has been given a face with the help of a self-navigating robot that listens to its owner's commands.
The relationship between man and machine just got a little closer. RoboTeam is a tech startup company from Tel Aviv that designed this robot called Teamy. The robot can follow its owner and responds to voice commands. It can also be controlled using a smartphone app.
If I tap this button, Teamy locks on my body and face, and it starts following my face and body. It tracks me so I can enjoy hands-free video calls.
Teamy uses 16 sensors to help it get around and avoid falling down the stairs. But designers say its abilities to instantly map its surroundings and learn places in your home make it the perfect video conferencing technology.
If I'm abroad and I want to read my kid a bedtime story, I can press on my phone Bobby's room and the robot will drive to Bobby's room and I can read him a bedtime story.
Wow, that's amazing.
Teamy uses technology mainly used in autonomous cars and now refined for the home. It's called LIDAR, a type of surveying method which uses lasers to measure and develop an accurate map of its surroundings. Designers say it's the first time the technology has been used in a home or office setting to avoid potential hazards in real time.
This obstacle avoidance and this navigation technology has never been achieved in home robotics by any company. And it is one of the main reasons which make this robot much more user-friendly for the home and office.
RoboTeam recently unveiled Teamy at the IFI Consumer Electronics Trade Show in Berlin. The company says end-user cost was a consideration when designing the robot, which will go on sale this October for about $1,500. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. Find us online at iTunes and SoundCloud, streaming, of course, on VOA Asia Facebook and our website, voanews.com. You'll also find us on Facebook in Myanmar, courtesy of Facebook VOA Burmese. Thanks to everybody who tuned in that way. We also thank our director, Tracy Carter, engineer Kelvin Fowler, managing editor Diane Gao, and our VOA Asia team. It includes Skylar Ogden, Ira Melman, and Doug Bernard. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. We hope you have a wonderful day.